star cruising altitude, it's time for the Flyover View.
Welcome back to Flyover View, a member of the Heartland Pod family of podcasts. So look at Heartland News from 30,000 feet. From the Gateway Arch to the Rocky Mountains, I'm your host, Kevin Smith, and I want to thank you for joining me today as we dive into the stories most impactful to you. Folks, let's begin today's show. The Inflation Reduction Act. A massive climate, healthcare, and tax bill is making its way toward President Biden's desk, and it's called the Inflation Reduction Act. The broad strokes highlights of this bill show that it enacts historic deficit reduction to fight inflation, lowers energy costs, increases cleaner energy production, and reduces carbon emissions by roughly 40% by 2030. It allows Medicare to negotiate drug prices and caps out-of-pocket costs to $2,000. It lowers ACA healthcare premiums for millions of Americans, makes the biggest corporations and ultra-wealthy pay their fair share with no new taxes on families making $400,000 or less, and no new taxes on small businesses. The bill closes tax loopholes and enforces the tax code. So, will we see an overnight drop in inflation? Not likely, but the bill will not add to the inflation rate and will take measured steps to lower inflation over time. There are three main ways the bill targets rising prices. First, it plans to reduce the federal deficit, which is the difference between how much the United States government spends and how much it makes in taxes and revenue. When there's less money floating in the economy, there tends to be less demand and fewer price hikes. Second, it will promote the production of certain goods, mainly in renewable energy. Having more supply than demand could help lower some costs over time. Third, and most directly, one provision of the bill will help limit the price growth of certain prescription drugs by allowing Medicare to negotiate their costs with pharmaceutical companies. The package includes $430 billion in new spending to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, invest in clean energy technologies, and extend subsidies for the Affordable Care Act. The bill also plans to bring in more than $300 billion in new revenue by imposing a 15% minimum tax on corporations making over $1 billion and through a new excise tax on corporate stock buybacks. Kent Smetters, faculty director of the Penn Wharton budget model, states that the way to think about this is not about inflation at all, but about the trade-offs between helping people who need more help, especially in healthcare and reducing carbon, versus the potential impact on future investment. This bill is yet another progressive win for the country, following so closely on the heels of the PACT Act, which expanded healthcare benefits to millions of veterans who were exposed to toxic burn pits during their military service, quickly after Republicans received tremendous blowback for trying to scuttle it, largely in response to the successful whipping of votes for the Inflation Reduction Act. Voters cannot, in good faith, point to this administration and say that it's not addressing progressive goals. From the American Rescue Plan to the Inflation Reduction Act, we have seen numerous goals met by this administration that would each individually be considered big news in their own right. Were the Biden administration not facing the consequences of a global war and a pandemic on our economy, perhaps we'd be seeing a little bit more crowing. Federal government steps in to help pull Missouri out of Medicaid backlog. Federal officials last month approved a plan to help Missouri deal with ongoing and persistent delays in processing Medicaid applications that have left the state out of compliance with federal standards for nearly a year. Longtime observers of the state's Medicaid program say the decision by Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to intervene is unusual and demonstrates how severe the application delays have become. The most recent publicly available data from the end of June shows Medicaid applicants waiting an average of 115 days for the state to process their paperwork, more than double what federal regulations allow. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS, work in tandem with state agencies to fund Medicaid, and states administer the program under broad federal guidelines. But CMS rarely steps in when states limit access to services or coverage. In general, when CMS works with states on mitigation plans, it's after months of dialogue that have failed to resolve compliance issues. Over 200,000 newly eligible Missourians have enrolled in Medicaid since expansion went into effect last year, but the state is still receiving a steady influx of new applications atop large backlog. Having over 200,000 people enrolled in Medicaid expansion, and you still have this many more that are waiting in a queue, really speaks to the need for federal involvement. For applicants, waiting months is often untenable. Long wait times deprive patients of their necessary medications, cause them to delay needed care, and forego preventative care altogether. Overcoming the compliance issues is of great urgency, some say, because more administrative hurdles lie on the horizon. In November, the federal marketplace enrollment season will open, which typically brings in a stream of new applicants to Medicaid, because the marketplace automatically transfers the applications of those too low an income to qualify for federal health care. Longer term, possibly early next year, the end of the federal public health emergency looms, which paused recertifications for Medicaid. The state cannot currently remove anyone from its Medicaid rolls. Once the public health emergency ends, the state must complete eligibility renewals for all Medicaid recipients, a process some worry could overwhelm the department, erroneously strip qualified patients of coverage, and strain the state's processing of new applications. One has to feel for the Division of Social Services as they try to meet this demand. It certainly hasn't helped that our state has faced tremendous pressure against expansion from its Republican leaders, despite public expectation that the job be done. Thankfully, the federal government is helping to pick up the slack, because beyond the partisan noise being made about who to point the finger at for fault over this, there are hundreds of thousands of people in Missouri right now that need medical coverage and care. We would do well to take that seriously. Higher chicken prices expected after a $4.5 billion poultry merger wins U.S. approval. Long-delayed approval from the Department of Justice on Cargill and Continental Grain's $4.5 billion acquisition of publicly traded Sanderson Farms has signaled a problem. Could even more consolidation in the chicken industry be coming? Farmers, distributors, and truckers, stakeholders up and down the supply chain are asking this very question. Now that there's a new poultry powerhouse backed by Cargill, a major trader of grain, the top expense for chicken farmers, and Continental Grain, the owner of Wayne Farms, America's sixth largest chicken processor. Though the Justice Department spent a year drilling deeply into the proposed joint acquisition of Sanderson, the third largest U.S. processor, the new company has taken form and will control an estimated 15% of the chicken market and push the market share of the top four competitors to more than 60% from about 50%. It could just be the start of a wave of consolidation for the chicken industry, experts warn. More of a crunch would further centralize power among the biggest processors. When that's happened in the past, chicken processors have often charged higher prices and kept more of the profits, while there's been little change to what farmers and factory workers are paid. Consumers ultimately lose and have fewer choices in the supermarket. Concerns over a further consolidation of the industry were tempered somewhat by the Justice Department's proposed consent decree with Sanderson, Cargill, and Wayne that would monitor the chicken companies for anti-competitive practices, pay workers for past harms, and prevent companies from exchanging information about wages and benefits. The consent decree would be significant. There's been a class action lawsuit gaining steam for months centered on allegations of decades-long wage manipulation scheme across the workers in the poultry industry. The proposed decree would require three processors, including Sanderson and Wayne, which are both named in the lawsuit, among more than a dozen defendants, to pay $84.8 million to processing plant workers. The lawsuit is part of a broader anti-competition probe into the chicken industry by the Department of Justice that's been going on for years. All of this is troubling in an era of weak regulation of concentrated animal feeding operations at the federal and state level. A recent op-ed by Missouri farmer Doug Dowdy caught my eye this week in the Missouri Independent, and I wanted to end this story with some of his words. Doug states, "In 1997, my county enacted a local health ordinance to govern CAFOs. The ordinance did not ban CAFOs, but was stronger than state regulations. But 20 Missouri health ordinances fell victim to intense lobbying from corporate agriculture in 2019, another domino to fall in a series of laws to deregulate the industry. We were taking a reasonable approach, but the attack on local control takes that tool away, and our state government, commandeered by corporate agriculture, has eroded state protections and regulations on CAFOs to near EPA baseline. Federal regulations of CAFOs are weak. The EPA doesn't have regulations in place to protect us from CAFOs, nor the political will to improve them. But the EPA is our last line of defense. In the meantime, the United States Department of Agriculture funds CAFOs to pay for manure lagoons, animal mortality facilities, and manure management. Why is the USDA underwriting pollution with conservation dollars? Let's direct a larger percentage of the USDA dollars towards small and mid-sized family farms seeking to implement cover crops, sustainable livestock practices, farmers selling directly to consumers, urban ag projects, and neighborhood kitchen and grocery incentives. Let's fund resourceful farming and food initiatives that contribute to the public good." Now, consolidation and CAFOs are twin dangers to the local farmer, and frankly, our pocketbooks and the environment. I echo Mr. Dowdy's sentiment. Fund and support the neighborhood farmer, not the corporations. To do that, though, we will need to elect progressive leaders who will. Folks, before we hit the break, I want to inform you that we're taking a brief layover with candidate Tracy Grundy. Tracy is a Democratic candidate for state representative, hoping to represent House District 107. Tracy, welcome to the Flyover View today, and how are you doing?
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here today with you.
Great. And just to jump right in, so you're running in a district. Well, Missouri is kind of a state where running is difficult, especially for Democrats and progressives. So what made you decide to run for state representative?
Okay, I ran in 2020, and that was a tough run because it was during the COVID pandemic. We couldn't do anything, couldn't meet with anyone, just kind of wore masks and snuck flyers under people's doormats. I lost that election and decided the fight wasn't over yet, and decided to give it another try again. So running again this year. I've been really distressed about the direction that the GOP has been taking in Missouri with regards to body autonomy, voter suppression, trans rights, the pushing of the CRT issue in the public schools. And I really felt like I needed to step up and do something to help change the dynamics.
Well, and we definitely appreciate all of our strong progressives that are getting out there and actually running. We sometimes have difficulty even getting someone to run, especially, and seeing a strong candidate like yourself run is great. But speaking to your background, what makes you confident that you can represent District 107? What would you say you bring to the table for the constituency?
First of all, I have a degree in education, so I do understand how education works and how teachers work and how that public school system works. I also have a background in sales and management. I've been in retail, a store manager, a district manager, a regional director. So I've managed hundreds of people at any given time. Lately, in the last 10, 12 years, I've been in human resources. So I do have a certification through SHRM. If anybody knows what SHRM is, it's the Society of Human Resources Management. I do understand how to mediate people's differences through my experience as employee counseling and relations. I have a total understanding of labor laws, employment laws, those kinds of things. I also have an understanding of economies, budgets, how to do that since I've been in sales management for many years. I'm also a mom who has two kids. One kid graduated from Francis Howell, and both my kids are college graduates and doing well. So I've been very involved in their lives through school. So I've been on the mom side as well, too. I'm very active in my church. I am an elder in my church and head of the missions committee. So I think because I've done so many different things with a background in education, a background in sales and management, a background in human resources, involved in my church, involved in the schools, I think I've touched a lot of different facets, and I think I can really talk to people and represent their needs.
Well, and just a little inside baseball, when I said earlier that you were a strong candidate, it's because I had read all those things on your website. I knew all of this going into it. And that's why I said you sound like a strong candidate to represent the state of Missouri in your district. Being a former teacher to me is very important. My wife's an educator. Missouri is definitely a difficult place for educators. So I love hearing that on top of the mountain of other issues that you have.
Exactly.
And on your website, you say, and this is one of the quotes I liked the most, was we need to move our home state from the bottom of almost every ranking across the board into a place where we can proudly say, yes, Missouri is our home. So what does that mean to you? And what should it mean to your potential constituents?
I guess maybe because of my sales background and just because of my competitive nature, I like to be number one, maybe number two, if I have to be number two. And when you can even do a Google search and see where Missouri does in rankings across the board in so many different categories. We are almost in the bottom half, in the bottom third, sometimes dead last in so many categories. That's not something to be proud of. And since you do have a passion for education, you do know that in teacher pay and student funding, we are at the bottom of the barrel. That is not something to be proud of. I have talked to so many people who say, you know, I'm kind of embarrassed to be from Missouri. That shouldn't be how it should be. We should be super proud and super excited. If this is our home, we need to make our home be the best it can possibly be. And we need to make some changes in Jefferson City and what we are doing so that we can bring ourselves up in the rankings and be proud of what we are doing here in Missouri rather than ducking our heads and being embarrassed.
Yeah, Missouri is a beautiful state with some great people and some crappy politics.
Absolutely. I mean, I've only lived here since 2010. So I chose to make Missouri my home. It's not like I was born here and had to live here. I chose Missouri. And it is a gorgeous state. I mean, The natural resources are beautiful. They're amazing. The state is a beautiful state with so many things happening for it. Great schools, great public universities, great natural resources, some great economies as well too, some great job programs, excellent, amazing, great people. It's the politics that are going to ruin it.
Absolutely.
And we've got to make a difference. We got to do something.
So that bleeds into our next topic. A lot of folks don't have time to look at every issue when they're voting. For you, what is the one major issue that you would put in front of them if you wanted them to really know that you're looking to tackle that issue?
Okay. And I'm going to just put myself out there and say the pro-choice issue is, to me, the number one issue for many, many reasons. Obviously, for body autonomy is important. But if you have these very extreme abortion laws, you're going to hurt many other things. You're going to hurt our economy. There are businesses who are considering possibly relocating their businesses outside of Missouri, or they're having a very difficult time attracting women to Missouri and young families to Missouri because of the extreme laws. The universities are going to be struggling to get young people, especially women, to come here because of the extreme abortion laws. You are going to have so many, many problems with this law, besides just the moral and social complications of it, that I think we need to do something about that immediately and change that. And if you look overall nationally, 65% of people approved of the Roe v. Wade the way it stands. And then when you look at what Kansas just did, I can't believe that people in Missouri are too far away from how the people in Kansas felt. And I think if we address that, we could definitely make a change there.
You're absolutely right. I know a few weeks ago, I ran a story on Flyover View about Oklahoma losing a large contract because who wants to work there?
Right.
And body autonomy for women is definitely one of those key issues that employers are looking at beyond, like you say, the moral implications of telling someone that they're a second-class citizen when it comes to their healthcare rights.
Exactly.
So how can folks find you if they're looking for like your social handles, your web page?
Well, I'm pretty active on Twitter. Tracy Grundy for Missouri on Twitter. My website is Tracy Grundy for Missouri. Pretty much everything is Tracy Grundy for Missouri. And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, webpage, all those things. And if you do want to email me, you can connect through my email, through my webpage as well, TracyGrundyForMissouri.com.
All right. And are there any upcoming events you want to highlight?
Nothing upcoming very, very soon, but we will be planning. I'm in the process of planning some very large canvassing. We want to hit at least 5,000 to 6,000 homes in my district before the election. So I will be looking for volunteers. And if you want to volunteer, sign up on my webpage to volunteer. We'll be coordinating that very shortly.
Awesome. I hope anybody out there listening who lives in the 107 can. I mean, I live in the 107. I might be helping out here in the near future.
I predict a sign in your front yard.
Absolutely. I'd love one. Well, thank you so much, Tracy. I really appreciate you taking the time to join me here on the Flyover View, and best of luck out there.
Thank you so much. Well, thank you for having me today.
Hey there, folks. I hope you're enjoying the show. I want to remind you that we are a 100% listener-supported family of podcasts, all under the umbrella of the Heartland Pod. You can catch our flagship show, The Heartland Pod, on Mondays every week with Adam Summer, where he delivers an opening statement before being joined by Sean Diller and Rachel Parker for Talking Politics. You can also join a variety of hosts on most Tuesdays and Thursdays for Let's Have a Chat, featuring interviews with folks of interest from around the Midwest. On Wednesdays, the focus shifts to a rotating cast of special reports, like The Delta, with Nicholas and Christina Linke, and High Country, Sean Diller's Western Political Updates. Learn more at heartlandpod.com, and don't forget, for full access to the Last Call episodes and the Heartland News blog, sign up on Patreon as a podhead today. And now, the lightning round. Lightning round. In Nebraska, a mother and teenager faced charges in teen's abortion after police obtained their Facebook direct messages. A Nebraska mother and her teenage daughter are facing criminal charges following the teen's abortion in April in a case where police obtained their Facebook messages about the abortion through a search warrant. 17-year-old Celeste Burgess and her mother, 41-year-old Jessica Burgess, were charged in early June after Jessica Burgess allegedly helped her daughter abort her fetus. Celeste is being tried as an adult in this case. The state alleges that the abortion itself was illegal because it was performed after the 20-week abortion ban the state had at the time and was not performed by a physician which was required by the state at the time. This case is one of the first instances of a person's Facebook activity being used to incriminate her in a state where abortion is restricted, following June's U.S. Supreme Court decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. Abortion rights activists, digital privacy experts, and anyone who's concerned about privacy in the United States have raised fears that people's digital communications, location data, period app tracking information, or other private data will be used against them to criminalize abortion. This Nebraska case shows that Facebook at least is willing to comply with court orders from the states that have criminalized abortion. Facebook previously said it would ban users who posted that they would mail abortion pills to people in states where it is banned or restricted. Climate change raising the costs. As climate change threatens the United States with more natural disasters, it's becoming increasingly costly for Americans to insure their homes, and it's only expected to get worse. There were 20 separate billion-dollar U.S. natural disasters in 2021, including a deep freeze, wildfires, flooding, tornado outbreaks, and other severe weather, costing a total of $145 billion. Some 90% of United States homeowners saw premiums jump from May 2021 to May of 2022, costing an average of $134 more per year. Concerns like wildfires are covered as part of a standard homeowner's insurance coverage, and policy premiums in fire-prone areas have also become more costly. Premiums rose by nearly 10% in California from May of 2021 to May of 2022, with the increase in costly wildfires partially to blame. Last October, FEMA revamped its program to more accurately assess flood risk, causing insurance premiums for some coastal properties to rise to $4,000 or $5,000 annually, up from just $700 to $800. These hikes may be prohibitively expensive for lower-income families or retirees, especially those who may be living in a property inherited from family. These family houses have been around forever, and they may not even have a mortgage on them, so flood insurance may not be required, but they should have it anyway. Billions pour into bioplastics. Bioplastics have long been used in medical applications. The stitches you got after cutting your hand slicing onions were likely made of bioplastic thread that harmlessly dissolved into your body. But the nascent bioplastics industry envisions a far bigger role for materials made from corn, sugar, vegetable oils, and other renewable materials in hopes of grabbing a larger share of a nearly $600 billion global plastic market. Bioplastics are easier to biodegrade than petrochemical plastic, which can take centuries to disintegrate, shedding the worry some microplastic along the way. Companies and investors see the opportunities. Data shows investment in bioplastic manufacturing reached $500 million in the first 3 months of 2022, and estimates say the bioplastics market will surge from $10.5 billion in 2021 to some $29 billion in 2028. A vaccine for Lyme disease in final clinical trial. Ticks that carry Lyme disease have been on the march, spreading into more forests and brush areas around the United States and Europe. Lyme disease is spread by black-legged ticks. Climate change and deforestation are among the human-caused factors that have increased the range of the arachnids. The removal of predators that control populations of deer and mice, two animals that carry Lyme, have also helped the disease spread. But lovers of the outdoors could get a new weapon against Lyme if a new vaccine candidate performs well. It aims to protect people as young as five. If it were to gain regulators' approval, it would become the only Lyme disease vaccine available for humans in the United States. But it's expected to take years for the potential vaccine to reach the market. If the phase 3 study is a success, the companies say they would likely seek official authorization in 2025. Wisconsin Dems rally behind potential history maker Mandela Barnes in lead-up to key race. After several major candidates dropped out of Wisconsin's Democratic Senate primary within a week of one another, the party has coalesced around Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes with the goal of defeating incumbent Republican Senator Ron Johnson. Control of Congress's upper chamber could be at stake in one of the country's fiercest battlegrounds. Every day matters, and that's why the second I realized there was no path forward, we made sure that we did what we thought was best for us to be able to defeat Ron Johnson, says candidate Lazary, who is arguably Barnes' stiffest competition. In an interview with ABC News before the primary, Barnes called the endorsements of his former opponents huge. It feels great because it shows the momentum and also the strength that this campaign has, the broad coalition that we set out to build in the first place. Barnes, who is 35 years old, is also part of a key demographic in the state, millennials. Despite being the largest generation, millennials aren't proportionally represented in either chamber of the Congress, which has some Wisconsin voters calling for more generationally diverse leadership. And finally, Missouri is becoming a safer place as Third Boarding School closes. A Third Boarding School in Southwest Missouri, led by a former longtime staffer of the embattled Agape Boarding School, has closed. Schools like these often operate under the radar in secluded rural areas of the state. Josh Bradney, one of the 19 former Agape students who have lawsuits pending against that school, says, "I'm glad Missouri is becoming a safer place and people are realizing that these schools shouldn't be open and that more people are speaking out." The closure leaves Agape Boarding School, where five staffers currently face low-level felony charges alleging that they had assaulted students, as the only unlicensed Christian boarding school remaining in Cedar County, where there were once four. To date, Missouri's Attorney General and Republican Senate candidate Eric Schmidt has not done the necessary work needed to close this problematic business. Well, that's all the time we have this week, folks. I want to thank you for joining us. And if you feel you have a story that I should look into or possibly highlight on the show, please tweet me throughout the week at KevInMidmo or the pod's parent account at the Heartland Pod. This week's episode featured reporting and information from CNBC, the Missouri Independent, NPR, the Associated Press, CBS, Vice, Forbes, ABC, and the Kansas City Star. Thanks for listening.
Flyover View is a production of MidMap Media, LLC. Learn more at www.heartlandpod.com or at the Heartland Pod on Twitter. See y'all next week.